First case the court will take up this morning is in the matter of the estate of Neil William Schmank. Caitlin Cook is here this morning arguing on behalf of the appellant Denise Shipke Schmank, and John Burke is present and arguing on behalf of the appellee Ryan Schmank. So with that, Ms. Cook, you may proceed with your first 15-minute argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, law clerks. My name is Cook, and I represent the appellant, Denise Shipke Schmank. This appeal raises three issues before this court. The first issue deals with whether Denise's creditor claim is barred and whether her motion to approve her claim contains sufficient information so as to satisfy statute. The second issue is whether the trial court erred in determining that Denise did not provide adequate evidence to establish she lacks an adequate remedy at law. And the third issue is whether the trial court erred in utilizing SDCL 21-9-3 to refuse to enforce specific performance against Neil. I'm going to give a brief summary of facts because some of the dates are important to these issues that we are asking this court to review. This case involves an agreement to execute mutual wills between Denise and her former and late husband, Neil. This agreement was executed in 2017, and the parties agreed essentially that they would leave their estate upon their deaths to their children from prior marriages and respective shares. Unfortunately, after the parties signed that agreement, they began to have marital issues, caused at least in part by Neil's significant drinking problem. In April of 2019, unbeknownst to Denise, Neil executed a new will and also filed for divorce. This divorce was never finalized, and unfortunately, 2 months later, in June of 2019, Neil took his own life. Thereafter, Denise petitioned the trial court to admit the 2017 will to probate and to appoint her as personal representative of Neil's estate. Ryan, Neil's son, filed a similar petition seeking admission of the 2019 will and seeking that he be appointed as personal representative of Neil's estate. Following a full evidentiary hearing in October of 2019, wherein Denise's claim for breach of contract against Neil's estate was extensively discussed, the court found that the 2019 will would be admitted to probate, but instead decided to appoint Denise as personal representative of Neil's estate. Shortly thereafter, in December of 2019, Denise did two things as personal representative. The first was to provide required statutory information to the Department of Social Services, and the second was to publish a notice to unknown creditors stating if they didn't bring their claim within 4 months of publication, their claim was barred. She did not send any notices to known creditors at that time. Within 4 months after that date, December 12th of 2019, and April 8th of 2020, Denise filed a motion to approve her claim against the estate with the trial court. Following an evidentiary hearing later that year, the trial court eventually denied her motions for the reasons that I will discuss today, and it's from that order that Denise appeals. And justices, I have a very short amount of time and a lot of issues that I've raised before you. I'm fully prepared to go through the entire litany of my arguments, but if it would be more efficient for you to be able to ask questions or if there's a specific issue you'd like me to focus on, I'd be happy to take that approach as well.
Well, let me ask you this, Ms. Cook. Do you, and I don't know if the trial court really addressed this, maybe in a roundabout fashion he did, but do you think that a personal representative can serve both in both capacities as a personal representative and a creditor? Maybe in some, I don't know, is anything that per se prohibits it, but is in this case, is there kind of a fundamental conflict that exists for this individual who's really saying, hey, this 2019 will that I'm supposed to probate and administer, it's not valid. And is that a problem for her as personal representative and as creditor and asserting that sort of a claim?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, and that's for a couple different reasons. So first, I would note that in Ryan's briefing, they do focus very much on this sort of conflict between creditor and personal representative. However, if you look at the statutes that deal with creditor claims in South Dakota, specifically it's SDCL 29A3801, it doesn't differentiate between claims of personal representatives versus known creditor claims versus unknown creditor claims. It only differentiates between unknown creditors and known creditors. And so, actually, in one of the cases cited by Ryan in their brief, it's in Re Estate of Wickham, the Colorado Supreme Court says it better than I think that I could say it in my own briefing, is that had the South Dakota legislature intended to create some sort of different standard for creditor claims or for a representative who may have a creditor claim, it absolutely could have. And the Colorado legislature did not in that case, and South Dakota has not. There are multiple other jurisdictions wherein the legislature has imposed certain, you could call them protections or other standards when a personal representative holds their own claim, but South Dakota's legislature specifically has chosen not to do so. And so in this case, the 2019 will, when it was admitted to probate, during that same hearing, the trial court was well aware, as was Ryan and every other heir of the estate, that this breach of contract claim against the estate existed, and yet Denise was still appointed as personal representative. So, Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a conflict with her ability to administer. I mean, the court knew about it and still appointed her as personal representative. And I don't believe under the law that the legislature has intended for courts to draw any distinction between claims of a personal representative versus claims of known creditors. There's simply not a category for that.
What effect does the court's determination that it would be the 2019 will that would be admitted to probate, what effect does that have on your client's attempt to achieve a remedy of specific performance with respect to the contract relating to the 2017?
So, Your Honor, the 2019 will essentially stated that Neil wanted his children to receive everything they could and wanted to Denise to only receive what she was required to under the law. The contract, my client isn't attempting to enforce a will. She's attempting to enforce specifically the agreement to execute mutual wills. And so whether that will was admitted to probate isn't really pivotal to the question of her ability to seek specific performance of that separate agreement. That agreement is one wherein Neil was supposed to ask her permission, and where the parties had agreed that they would leave their estate to their children in respective shares. So she's specifically trying to enforce that contract. The 2019 will doesn't really change her breach of contract claim against the estate, wherein she's seeking that the estate be given to her as she's supposed to have received it under that agreement.
The specific request you made in the motion for approval of the claim is that the estate be disposed of as provided for in the 2017 will.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the 2017 will is the subject of that 2017 agreement to execute mutual wills. And so that agreement part and parcel is talking about the same estate and the disposition of the estate in that 2017 will. So what she's seeking is that the estate, which is real property subject to a contract for deed, be left to her as was agreed in the 2017 agreement. So
in effect, it's asking the court to proceed under the provisions of the 2017 will.
Yes, via a breach of contract claim, Your Honor.
Ms. Cook, is your argument in concerning the obligation to give notice that Denise didn't have to give any notice or she didn't have to give it on a particular time frame?
Your Honor, our argument is that Denise didn't have to give it within a particular time frame. So the position that we have taken, and I think it's supported as a matter of law by just pure statutory construction, there's no question that Denise falls within the definition of a known creditor under 801. So under that specific statutory language, known creditors must receive written notice, even if it seems absurd, they must receive written notice to bar their claim. The language is clear there. And so what Denise's position is that there is no, I guess, known creditor deadline. Each creditors, known creditors' deadline is specific to when they receive their written notice. So it's not that Denise didn't have to receive notice. It's that her time to bring her claim would not have accrued until after she received written notice.
So her failure to give notice in this case is what? Rendered moot or is harmless? Or she just wasn't subject to that obligation as things played out? Or what?
So, Your Honor, it would be our position that the failure to give notice, her claim isn't barred. She could still give notice at this time because 801B doesn't set any deadline by which a personal representative has to send written notice to known creditors.
You know, I understand your argument in that regard, and it seems like a really good, responsive argument, but if we go to build a rule from it, what are we going to say about that statute? If we go to say, okay, well, there's no deadline, true enough, but the language in the text of the statute nevertheless still requires the personal representative to give notice, as you say, shall give notice. And so we have to kind of figure out what that means and what that commands. It's not probably enough for us to pull from it to just say, well, there's no deadline. Or maybe it is. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, and Your Honor, there is a deadline. If you look at SDCL 29A3803, that specifically fixes a deadline wherein any creditor, regardless of their known, unknown, whether their claim's liquidated, unliquidated, they have to bring a claim within 3 years of the decedent's death. And so there are reasons that a PR administering an estate may give notice to creditors at different times. And that's exactly what 801 contemplates. It gives them the ability, they must provide notice. They obviously can't do it outside of that 3-year window because all claims are barred anyway. But the rule that Denise would request this court impose is that you strictly follow the language of the statute that requires written notice to bar a known creditor's claim.
But does the shall in 801 refer to personal representative shall give written notice or mail? Is that the mandatory part of that sentence relating to how to give the notice, not the fact that the creditor needs to give notice? So, for instance, if you have a personal representative. If you have a personal representative who chooses not to give notice, are they in violation of the statute, or does it just mean the creditor has 3 years to file their claim under 803?
Your Honor, I believe the statute requires that the personal representative must give notice to known creditors, but it must be in writing to bar their claim. And so there's a fail-safe with 803 that prevents, you know, claims being made, or in this case, the concern that Denise was somehow strategically utilizing this notice issue to somehow benefit her claim. 801 specifically says you've got to give notice. It's got to be written notice to bar a known creditor's claim. And 803 kind of provides you the bookend on the back end to say, look, you're not going to be able to do it outside of this 3-year window. So I do believe that it's that they must provide written notice. Whereas if you look at the unknown creditor statute, it says they may publish to bar unknown creditor claims. So I do think that those words are purposely chosen by the legislature, Your Honor.
But what's the purpose of giving the notice if you don't give it until 3 years? Why does it matter if you give a notice or not? Because it's going to expire after 3 years anyway, isn't it?
And, Your Honor, a personal representative does owe fiduciary duties to the heir, fiduciary duties to the estate. And so the statute says that it shall be given. And like I said, I candidly don't practice much in this area, but I do know that there are certain circumstances wherein it makes sense to be able to give notice at different times. So to the extent that the personal representative failed to give notice at all, I think there could be an argument that there would be a breach of fiduciary duty claim there, Your Honor, but that isn't at issue in this case.
Then I want to go to the merits on the specific performance claim. Are you jumping ahead? Is there been a finding of breach in this case? Didn't the court make a determination that I'm not going to make a decision whether or not even the contract is enforceable or whether it's breach? So how do you get to the remedy at this point if you don't even know if you have a breach?
And Your Honor, that's true. The court has not gotten to the merits of the breach of contract claim because the court barred Denise's ability to even bring the breach of contract claim. So to the extent that this court would reverse, it's not a reverse for a finding that Denise just gets half the estate. The merits of that breach of contract claim would still have to play out. But at this point, Denise can't even bring the breach of contract claim because the court has barred her claim in violation of the plain language of that statute, Your Honor. So you are correct. There has been no breach to be determined, and it may be that no breach is determined, but Denise hasn't even been given the opportunity to prove up that part of the claim.
So then is your remedy claim even ripe at this point?
Your Honor, I think that at this point, the more important issue for Denise would be the notice issue, to be able to bring that claim. Because I do think that if this court were to determine that Denise's notice was not barred or was timely or complied with 804, then I think that the specific performance issue to some extent becomes mooted. But it's just that she's completely stripped of a remedy here because she's not even allowed to bring that claim.
I don't know if you can see the time, but that's your time.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Burke, you can proceed with your argument.
Good morning. My name is John Burke. I represent the appellee, Ryan Smink. May it please the court, counsel, the law clerks, and the students. I might jump out of order a little bit because I'd like to follow up on a few things that the court asked opposing counsel. One of the questions that the court jumped into, I think properly, is the conflict of interest. And I know that counsel suggested there was sort of a conflict, but I think it's more fundamental than that, and I think it's kind of permeated the entire process. As I am sure, in the realities of practice, you can have creditors who at times are also the PR. This was kind of unique because the personal representative's creditor claim effectively wipes out the entire estate. So if there was a time where it might make sense to separate and put on that different hat, this would be a case where that would be appropriate. And the problem, unfortunately, has kind of continued all the way through to this appeal, Your Honor. The motion for approval of claim was actually filed by Denise as the personal representative. And so now Denise seems to be making the argument that the motion for approval was in fact the presentation of her claim. But the problem is she didn't file that as a creditor, she filed it as the PR. So we have a PR effectively filing this motion to approve a creditor's claim when in fact they're now trying to argue that was the creditor's claim. And so when I walk back a little bit, I think what shouldn't get lost here is this. This court is being asked to do several things by the appellant in order to reverse the circuit court. They would need to convince this court that she didn't have notice of the deadline to present her claim, okay? Number two, they would have to convince this court that the motion for approval, rather than a presentation of claim in accordance with either delivering it to the PR or filing it with the court and copied on the PR, that was instead the presentation of claim. They would have to convince this court that the circuit court erred when it found judicial estoppel. And next, they would have to convince this court that despite seeking what is commonly known as an extraordinary remedy of specific performance, that they did not need to put on evidence, demonstrate, and argue the lack of an adequate remedy at law. And then finally, they would have to convince this court, when you get to the merits, that the circuit court abused its discretion when it found that it was going to not deny specific performance of this claim.
Counsel, what process should she have followed to present her claim properly?
In my mind, honestly, first of all, she vigorously pursued being the PR. So in my mind, the more prudent course would have been that she not be the PR when she's the creditor that's going to literally take it all. But setting that aside for a second, I think the course would have been, honestly, for full transparency, the statute gives you two options if you're going to present your claim other than with a lawsuit. You can either deliver it or mail it to the PR, or you can file it with the court, copied on the PR. In my mind, the prudent course would have been so that everybody's aware of what's going on here, unknown, known creditors in the court file, is the best course would have been for her to file a presentation of her claim within that time frame and then copy it on herself, given the unique circumstance of the heavy conflict that she bears.
File within what time frame?
In my mind, she had to go by the 4 months. The circuit court found that effectively she was on notice and found that she had notice at the latest by the time that they let the DSS know. Because the when she had her PR hat on and served the DSS with notice, they actually referenced 801 in that notice and used the language saying you must bring your claim within 4 months or 60 days of this, whichever is later. And so she's out there saying, hey, this is the deadline for unknown creditors. I'm going to tell DSS this is your deadline. But she's basically trying to convince the circuit court in this court now, I wasn't really given notice.
So and, what unfair advantage did she obtain by not doing it at that time?
In my mind, the unfair advantage would be that while all other creditors, unknown in particular, are going to be wiped out within a short time frame, she's allowed now essentially a pass, if you will, and she will get to now present her claim and wipe out the entirety of the estate when known and unknown creditors would have just a short time frame to present their claims.
Well, she's still got to win. She may not be able to. She may not be able to win on the merits. But let me ask you, how should we read 801B and how should we construe that text under subsection B regarding personal representatives' obligation to provide notice to known creditors?
Justice, I think that's a good question, and I appreciate that 801A references, you know, on appointment, but we have to keep in mind that 801B does have mandatory language, you shall do this, okay? Now, we also know that generally the PR as a fiduciary for the estate has an obligation to, we'll say, expeditiously and speedily work toward the resolution of an estate. And in my mind, I know that opposing counsel, when she was asked this question, she said, well, she didn't have to give herself notice within a particular time. But then I think later agreed that that's problematic because the statute says you shall do it. Now, maybe it doesn't say within 6 days or 8 days or a week, but you shall do it. And in this case, she did start that process. And so for her to deny that she was on notice of something that everyone agrees she knew and the circuit court found that she was known to herself.
So in your argument then, would the rule from our effort to construe that text be what? That the personal representative must move with dispatch or reasonable expediency or whatever, but something like that? Is that the rule you're suggesting?
Yes.
I mean, I don't mean to tell you. I mean, I'm just throwing that out there.
No, I mean, if you look at, no, that's a fair way to look at it. If you look at 29A3-101, it refers to seeking to facilitate the prompt settlement of estates, okay? And so there is that fiduciary obligation to move forward. But I disagree with Denise's argument fundamentally is she seems to be suggesting that the circuit court was legislating a date or trying to rewrite the statute. And I don't think the circuit did that. What the circuit court, I think, felt uncomfortable with was that Denise was signing personally the notice for publication to creditors. She was acting through her counsel and serving the DSS and referencing 801. I don't think the circuit court was comfortable with her saying, after she realizes that she missed her timeline, to come back and say, well, wait a minute, I didn't get notice. And that gets into judicial estoppel and the inconsistency there. He said, no, you actually were aware. Everyone knows of that. I'm not going to, in my mind, the circuit court wasn't comfortable with letting her try to walk that dichotomy and say, now that she's realized she missed her timeline, well, I didn't get notice. You know, I look at it in terms of in the everyday practice, if I set up a hearing on a motion for summary judgment and I issue a notice of hearing, but then I don't show up at the hearing, I don't know if the judge would think it was cute if I said, well, wait a minute, I didn't get served with it. I think the court would look at me and say, well, wait a minute, you served the notice. You were on notice because you served it. Here, she was on notice and knew. So he's focusing on the knowledge that she had and not allowing her to effectively abandon her knowledge and notice for purposes of getting around her failure to timely present a claim.
Well, Mr. Burke, let me ask you this. Assuming I were to read 801 as you suggest. So she served or she filed with the clerk this document that she refers to as her claim. one day before the 4 months ran. So assuming it's properly submitted, don't we have a timely claim?
If the court...
And that's an issue in the case, whether it's properly submitted. I realize that, but don't we really go past the timeliness issue and go right to the question of, is this properly submitted?
If the court were to say, you know what, we're going to move into whether there was a presentation, the problem, there wasn't even substantial compliance with that statute, Your Honor. There's a few reasons. First of all, she didn't file it as a creditor. And I know that the appellee, we have focused on that in this case, but it's a fundamental distinction. At a minimum, even in from a perspective of notice pleading, okay, at a minimum, it seems like the creditor claim should have been filed by Denise herself. It wasn't. It was actually filed under Chapter 7, 713, where a PR is allowed to seek approval of a claim if there's a conflict of interest. So it doesn't even meet substantial compliance, even if the court wanted to go down that path. It's not filed by her as a creditor. It presupposes that there was a claim presented. If you read it, you know, motion for approval of payment of claim, it's presupposing that a claim was in fact presented when that never really happened. And finally, it lacked much of the detail that the statute requires. So I think even if you move to that, her motion for approval of payment of claim as a creditor is not sufficient to present her claim as a, she filed it as a personal representative, is not sufficient to constitute presentation of her claim as a creditor.
So if we were to find that it's the 3-year statute or the 3-year time frame that applies here, does the claim that she filed in February of 21 satisfy the presentment requirements? The more recent claim that she filed apparently in her personal capacity.
She filed a statement of claim in February 2021. I don't know whether she also copied it on herself as the PR. I don't know that. But it appears that in large part it would meet a statement of a claim under the statute. And again, that's filed after the court, though, has already barred her claim. But it appears much more compliant than the initial one, and it appears to be at least filed in a different capacity.
Let's assume we find the first... motion timely. Let's assume we say it's properly submitted under the statute. You keep raising this conflict. What's the remedy if she has a conflict? What's the remedy if she's got a timely claim that's been properly submitted, but she's got this conflict? What does the court do about that?
Oh, in my mind, that's where 713 comes in. Had she timely presented a claim in an appropriate form under the statute as a creditor, you would then move to should it be allowed or disallowed. And then Denise would have had to put on her other hat and either allow it or disallow it. And at that time, I think then Denise, as personal representative, would have filed a motion with the court saying, hey, this claim's a little tricky here. I've got a massive conflict of interest, and that way people can come challenge it. I think that's the sequence that should have been followed if it was going to happen.
Well, where's the prejudice here? I mean, the court's aware of the breach of contract claim. The parties are aware. Where is her motion for approval of claim lacking any notice as to the real issues? The value of the claim isn't set forth.
Yes, there are a number of things that are missing, Your Honor. The problem is this. It's true, there was discussion that this that existed and people knew that it was out there. But if you go down that path, if this court goes down the path of saying, well, everybody kind of knew, if you look at the Houston case and other cases, many of these statutes are strictly construed. And that's going to take this court and the circuit courts down a path where there's going to be arguments about, well, everybody kind of knew it was going on. The prejudice seems to me that... I don't think anyone thinks that if it had been Ryan presenting this as a creditor claim or someone else, that there would be this much debate if they would have said, you didn't timely present your claim, what's the harm? The fact that she happens to be the creditor and the PR doesn't give her a pass on that deadline. And the prejudice, obviously, is to the heirs of the estate that effectively won't take anything because it'll be wiped out. And we wouldn't allow it with other creditors. The fact that someone is also the PR doesn't allow someone to that extra time and a mulligan, if you will. There's only two other things because I think my time is short. But I do think not proving the lack of an adequate remedy at law is critical. It's not something that can be looked past. And it's not something that was a surprise at the conclusion of the trial. That was in our objection to the motion 5 months before trial. We said, hey, adequate remedy of law is important. The last thing I wanted to touch upon is in the Mead case coming out of the Michigan Court of Appeals. And I understand the statutory schemes are a little different, but the point there was the same. They struggled with the exact issue that this court's talking about. Does a PR give themselves a piece of paper or not? And what do we do if they don't have to? And they finished with this quote. It is at best difficult to imagine that the legislature intended that a personal representative who has actual notice would, one, be required to serve notice upon herself, and two, be in a position to give herself up to 3 years to present a claim by failing to exercise a fiduciary duty when general creditors, some of whom might never receive actual notice, get only 4 months to do so. And I think that drives home the point here that she doesn't get the benefit from, whether it's inadvertence or intentional, a PR doesn't get the benefit of extending their own time when others wouldn't.
Thank you, Mr. Berg.
We'd ask that the court affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cook, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bear with me.
Can I just jump in with a quick question?
Of course.
I want to follow up on Mr. Berg's.
Of course.
Let's assume we get to specific performance and adequate remedy, which you've alleged. If that's the case, couldn't you? I mean, she's got a life interest in this one half of the contract that she's saying should have been given to her, and she'd have the same thing if she got specific performance. She'd have a life interest. Couldn't you come in and have an economist or an expert or somebody say, okay, here's her life expectancy, here's the present value of that, and here's the amount of the claim that she would expect to receive over the course of her lifetime under the payments? Why couldn't you do that? Why isn't that an adequate remedy?
Your Honor, that's actually an interesting question, and it's made more difficult by the way that this case is situated. So, yes, I suppose you arguably could try to come in and do that. What makes this difficult is that typically when you're looking at breach of mutual wills, it tends to be the second party that's breaching after the first spouse or party has passed away. And so you could try to reduce it for present value and, consumption and what have you. But you're essentially speculating as to what might happen. You know, Denise could die 30 years from now. She could die 10 years from now. And so
we do that all the time in personal injury cases. We say somebody's going to have these kind of damages, medical expenses or non-economic loss and their life expectancies. We never say that's speculation.
And in this case, Your Honor, I mean, it ultimately is dealing with a piece of real property. And so specific performance is presumed to be the adequate remedy when it comes to contracts that deal with real property. So that's one reason. The other reason is, as I've said, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to be able to ascertain.
The conveyance, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this isn't the conveyance. This is the right to receive a stream of income from a contract or deed. So she's not the beneficiary of a conveyance of real property. This is one step removed from that.
She could be, Your Honor. If the contract for deed was breached, she has a reversion in that contract for deed. So it's still that real property that's the subject of the estate, essentially, that we're dealing with here. So while you could arguably try to bring in an economist to do that, the only real way to uphold the end of the bargain that Neil agreed to do this. He wasn't strong-armed into it. There's no, assertion that that's the case. The only way to ensure that it is what it would have been had he upheld his end of the bargain is to specifically enforce the contract. And if I may, just address a couple other questions, unless you have more for me.
I have one question.
Of course.
What if we conclude that remedy, so leaving aside for a moment the notice and the presentment questions, and if we were to jump ahead, kind of as the Chief Justice has suggested, and we just address this remedial question, if we were to figure out, or if we were to conclude that the relief that sought the specific performance is really nothing more than an end run to the claim to probate the earlier reciprocal will that wasn't successful and wasn't appealed and isn't before us. If we were to conclude that those were one and the same, that would bar all of your claims. I know it's not what you want, but that would really make the rest of the issues fall away in a way that's adverse to you. I understand that. But I think that that's a critical question. I think this remedial question is very critical. And Justice Stefani, I think, touched on it a little bit earlier. Is this just the case that it wasn't, she didn't prevail on the request to probate the earlier reciprocal will, and so now this is an effort to skirt that ruling?
Your Honor, I think that it's overlooking the fact that she has a valid breach of contract claim here. So it's an attempt to skirt the fact that the 2019 will was admitted to probate and the 2017 will wasn't. It's an attempt to bring her breach of contract claim.
How do they look different, though? I understand the distinction you're making, but in practice, and in practical effect, how are they any different?
In a practical effect, they're different in that it's not, A, she's not appealing the fact that the 2019 will was admitted to probate, but she has a breach of contract claim. And so while it may ultimately end up in the same property being given back to her in the same way, that doesn't invalidate the fact that he agreed to do something and he breached that agreement. So I don't think that that is a runaround.
Which is precisely her argument, probably, to get the reciprocal will in initially.
But she has a breach of contract claim, and that's the difference, Your Honor, is that you can't disregard the breach of contract claim because it's valid. He signed an agreement, and he breached it. And, of course, the merits are yet to be played out, but that is the case. So very briefly, I don't have a lot of time. I would like to address the two hats argument that's continually made, and I want to read something from the Wickham case that's actually cited by appellee, but is in favor of my client. Had the framers of the Colorado Probate Code intended to provide a different method for presentation of claims when the claimant and the personal representative are one and the same person, they could have done so. They did not. South Dakota's legislature absolutely could have done that. They could have said that if you're a PR, you present your claim in a different way than 801 says or than 804 says. They did not do so. And it's legislating to try to go beyond that.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess until 9:45.